wonderfully direct, unconceptualized view of the world. Stephen may be limited, odd, idiosyncratic, autistic, but it is given him to achieve what few of us do, a significant representation and investigation of the world. An anthropologist on Mars.
I had just returned from a few days with Stephen Wiltshire in July. I had driven up to Massachusetts to visit another autistic artist, Jessie Park, whose mother describes her in a most beautiful and intelligent personal narrative, The Siege, and had seen her intensely colored, star-studded drawings, very different from Stephen's, and something of her labyrinthine magic world of correlations between numbers, colors, morality, the weather. I had paid flying visits to several schools for autistic children. I had spent an extraordinary week at a camp for autistic children, Camp Winston in Ontario, the more so as one of the counselors there this summer was a friend of mine, Shane, with Tourette syndrome, who, with his lungings and touchings, reachings and buttings, his enormous vitality and impulsiveness, seemed able to get through to the most deeply autistic children in a way the rest of us were unable to do. Turning west, I had visited an entire autistic family in California. Both parents, highly gifted, and their two children, all of them given, between the serious business of life, to jumping on trampolines, flapping their hands, and screaming. And now, finally, I was on my way to Fort Collins in Colorado to see Temple Grandin, one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. In spite of her autism, she holds a Ph.D. in animal science, teaches at Colorado State University, and runs her own business. While autism was described almost simultaneously by Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger in the 1940s, Kanner seemed to see it as an unmitigated disaster, where Asperger felt that it might have certain positive or compensating features, a particular originality of thought and experience, which may well lead to exceptional achievements in later life. It is clear, even in these first accounts, that there is a wide range of phenomena and symptoms in autism, and many more can be added to those that Kanner and Asperger listed. A majority of Kanner-type children are retarded, often severely. A significant proportion have seizures and may have soft neurological signs and symptoms, a whole range of repetitive or automatic movements such as spasms, tics, rocking, spinning, finger play, or flapping of the hands, problems of coordination and balance, peculiar difficulties sometimes in initiating movements, akin to what is seen in Parkinsonism. There may also be very prominently, a large range of abnormal and often paradoxical sensory responses, with some sensations being heightened and even intolerable. Others, which may include pain perception, being diminished or apparently absent. There may be, if language develops, odd and complex language disorders, a tendency to verbosity, empty chatter, cliché-ridden and formulaic speech. The psychologist Doris Allen describes this aspect of their autism as a semantic pragmatic deficit. In contrast, Asperger-type children are often of normal and sometimes very superior intelligence and generally have fewer neurological problems. Kanner and Asperger looked at autism clinically, providing descriptions of such fullness and accuracy that even now, 50 years later, they can hardly be bettered. But it was not until the 1970s that Beata Hermelin and Neil O'Connor and their colleagues in London, trained in the new discipline of cognitive psychology, focused on the mental structure of autism in a more systematic way. Their work, and that of Lorna Wing in particular, suggests that in all autistic individuals, there is a core problem, a consistent triad of impairments. Impairment of social interaction with others, impairment of verbal and nonverbal communication, and impairment of play and imaginative activities. The appearance of these three together, they feel, is not fortuitous. All are expressive of a single fundamental developmental disturbance. Autistic people, they suggest, have no true concept of or feeling for other minds, or even their own. They have, in the jargon of cognitive psychology, no theory of mind. However, this is only one hypothesis among many. No theory as yet encompasses the whole range of phenomena to be seen in autism. Kanner and Asperger were still, in the 1970s, pondering the syndromes they had delineated more than 30 years earlier. And the foremost workers of today have all spent 20 years or more considering them. Autism as a subject touches on the deepest questions of ontology, for it involves a radical deviation in the development of brain and mind. Our insight is advancing, but tantalizingly slowly. The ultimate understanding of autism may demand both technical advances and conceptual ones beyond anything we can now even dream of. The picture of classical infantile autism is a formidable one. Most people, and indeed most physicians, if asked about autism, summon up a picture of a profoundly disabled child with stereotyped movements, perhaps head banging, rudimentary language, almost inaccessible, a creature for whom very little future lies in store. Indeed, in a strange way, most people speak only of autistic children and never of autistic adults, as if the children somehow just vanished from the earth. But though there may indeed be a devastating picture at the age of 3, some autistic youngsters, contrary to expectations, may go on to develop fair language, a modicum of social skills, and even high intellectual achievements. They may develop into autonomous human beings, capable of a life that may at least appear full and normal, even though beneath it there may remain a persistent and even profound autistic singularity. Asperger had a clearer idea of this possibility than Kanner. Hence we now speak of such high-functioning autistic individuals as having Asperger's syndrome. The ultimate difference, perhaps, is this. People with Asperger's syndrome can tell us of their experiences, their inner feelings and states, whereas those with classical autism cannot. With classical autism, there is no window, and we can only infer. With Asperger's syndrome, there is self-consciousness, and at least some power to introspect and report. Whether Asperger's syndrome is radically different from classical infantile autism, in a child of 3 all forms of autism may look the same, or whether there is a continuum from the severest cases of infantile autism, accompanied perhaps by retardation and various neurological problems, to the most gifted, high-functioning individuals, is a matter of dispute. Isabelle Crapin, a neurologist who specializes in autism, stresses that the two conditions may be separate at the biological level, even if they are sometimes similar at the behavioral level. It is also unclear whether this continuum should be extended to include the possession of isolated autistic traits, peculiar intense preoccupations and fixations, often combined with relative social withdrawal or remoteness, such as one encounters in any number of people, conventionally called normal, or seen at most as a little odd, eccentric, pedantic, or reclusive. The cause of autism has also been a matter of dispute. Its incidence is about 1 in 1,000, and it occurs throughout the world, its features remarkably consistent, even in extremely different cultures. It is often not recognized in the first year of life, but tends to become obvious in the second or third year. Though Asperger regarded it as a biological defect of affective contact, innate, inborn, analogous to a physical or intellectual defect, Kanner tended to view it as a psychogenic disorder, a reflection of bad parenting, and most especially of a chillingly remote, often professional, refrigerator mother. At this time, autism was often regarded as defensive in nature, or confused with childhood schizophrenia.
A whole generation of parents, mothers particularly, were made to feel guilty for the autism of their children. It was only in the 1960s that this trend began to reverse, and the organic nature of autism to be fully accepted. Bernard Rimland's 1964 text, Infantile Autism, played an important part here. That the disposition to autism is biological is no longer in doubt, nor the increasing evidence that it is, in some cases, genetic. Genetically, autism is heterogeneous. It is sometimes dominant, sometimes recessive. It is much more common in males. The genetic form may be associated in the affected individual or the family with other genetic disorders, such as dyslexia, attention deficit disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, or Tourette syndrome. But autism may also be acquired. This was first realized in the 1960s with the epidemic of rubella, when a large number of babies exposed to this prenatally went on to develop autism. It remains unclear whether the so-called regressive forms of autism, with sometimes abrupt losses of language and social behavior in 2 to 4 year olds who had previously been developing relatively normally, are genetically or environmentally caused. Autism may be a consequence of metabolic problems such as phenylketonuria, or mechanical ones such as hydrocephalus. Autism or autism-like syndromes may develop even in adult life, though infrequently, especially after certain forms of encephalitis. Some of my awakenings patients, I think, had elements of autism too. And yet, the parents of an autistic child, who find their infant receding from them, becoming remote, inaccessible, unresponsive, may still be tempted to blame themselves. They may find themselves struggling to relate to and love a child who seemingly does not love them back. They may make superhuman efforts to get through, to hold on to a child who inhabits some unimaginable, alien world, and yet all their efforts may seem to be in vain. The history of autism indeed has been in part a desperate search for and promotion of breakthroughs of various sorts. One father of an autistic boy expressed this to me with some bitterness. They come up with a new miracle every 4 years. First, it was elimination diets, then magnesium and vitamin B, then forced holding, then operant conditioning and behavior modification. Now all the excitement is about auditory desensitization and facilitated communication. This boy at 12 was still tantalizingly mute and unreachable, and his condition had defied every form of attempted therapy. Hence his father's pessimism and blanket condemnation. Responses seem to be extremely varied. Some individuals may respond spectacularly to some of these methods, while others show virtually no response at all. No two people with autism are the same. Its precise form or expression is different in every case. Moreover, there may be a most intricate and potentially creative interaction between the autistic traits and the other qualities of the individual. So while a single glance may suffice for clinical diagnosis, if we hope to understand the autistic individual, nothing less than a total biography will do. My own first experience with the autistic was in a grim ward in a state hospital in the mid-60s. Many of these patients, perhaps a majority, were also retarded. Many had seizures. Many had violent, self-abusive behaviors, such as head-banging. Many had other neurological problems. These worst-off patients tended to be multiply handicapped in addition to their autism, and several had been traumatized by abuse. And yet, even in this population, there were sometimes islands of ability, occasionally spectacular talents, shining through the devastation, precisely as Kanner and Asperger had described. Remarkable numerical or graphic powers, for instance. It was these special talents, apparently isolated from the rest of the mind and personality, and maintained by a passionate, intensely focused fixation or motivation, these savant syndromes that engaged my special interest and that I explored most deeply at the time. And even in this population of the seemingly hopeless, there were some who responded to individual attention. One young patient, nonverbal, responded to music and danced. Another, after some weeks, started to play pool with me, and later in the botanical garden said his first word, dandelion. Many of these patients, born in the 1940s or early 1950s, had not even been diagnosed as autistic when young, but had been lumped together indiscriminately with the retarded and psychotic and warehoused in huge institutions since early childhood. This is probably how the severely autistic have been treated for centuries. It has only been in the last 2 decades or so that the picture for such youngsters has decisively changed, with increasing medical and educational awareness of their special strengths and problems, and the widespread introduction of special schools and camps for autistic children. Visiting a few of these during August, I had seen a variety of children, some intelligent, some mildly retarded, some outgoing, some timid, all with their own individual personalities. At one such school, as I approached, I had seen some children in the playground, swinging and playing ball. How normal, I thought. But when I got closer, I saw one child swinging obsessively in terrifying semicircles, as high as the swing would go. Another throwing a small ball monotonously from hand to hand. Another spinning on a roundabout, around and around. Another not building with bricks, but lining them up endlessly in neat, monotonous rows. All were engaged in solitary, repetitive activities. None was really playing or playing with any of the others. Some of the children inside, when not in classes, would rock back and forth. Some would flap their hands or jabber unintelligibly. Occasionally, one of the teachers told me, a few of the children would have sudden panics or rages and scream or hit out uncontrollably. Some of the children would echo any words that were spoken to them. One boy apparently had an entire television show by heart and would replay it all day, complete with all the voices and gestures and even sounds of applause. At Camp Winston, an attractive 6-year-old boy had been given a pair of scissors and was cutting minute H's, a fraction of an inch high, each perfect, from a piece of paper. Most of the children looked physically normal. It was their remoteness, their inaccessibility, that were so uncanny. Some, in adolescence, were starting to emerge, to speak fluently, to learn social skills, much more difficult for such children than any academic learning, to create social surfaces they could present to the world. Without special schooling, schooling that for many had started in the nursery or at home, these autistic youngsters, despite their often good intelligence and background, might have remained profoundly isolated and disabled. They had certainly learned, many of them, to operate after a fashion, to show at least a formal or external recognition of social conventions. And yet, the very formality or externality of their behavior was itself disconcerting. I felt this especially at one school I visited, where children would stick out rigid hands and say in loud, unmodulated voices, "Good morning, my name is Peter. I am very well, thank you. How are you?" Without any punctuation or intonation, affect or tone, in a sort of litany. Would any of them, I wondered, ever achieve true autonomy? Use their social automatisms pragmatically as a way of functioning in the world, but beyond this, achieve a true inwardness of their own, perhaps a profoundly different inner life of an autistic sort, perhaps an inner life known or shown only to a few others. Uta Frith has written in her book, Autism, explaining the enigma, "Autism does not go away. Nevertheless, autistic people can, and often do, compensate for their handicap to a remarkable degree. but there remains a persistent deficit, something that cannot be corrected or substituted. She also implies, in a speculative mood, that there may be a reverse side to this something, a sort of moral or intellectual intensity or purity so far removed from the normal as to seem noble, ridiculous, or fearful to the rest of us. She wonders in this regard about the blessed fools of old Russia, about the ingenuous Brother Juniper, an early follower of St. Francis, and, interestingly, about Sherlock Holmes, with his oddness, his peculiar fixations. His little monograph on the ashes of 140 different varieties of pipe, cigar, and cigarette tobacco. His clear powers of observation and deduction, unclouded by the everyday emotions of ordinary people. And the extreme unconventionality that often allows him to solve a case that the police, with their more conventional minds, are unable to solve. Asperger himself wrote of autistic intelligence and saw it as a sort of intelligence scarcely touched by tradition and culture. Unconventional, unorthodox, strangely pure and original, akin to the intelligence of true creativity. Dr. Frith, when we met in London, expanded on these themes and said I must be sure to visit one of the most remarkable autistic people she knew, to see her at work and at home, to spend time with her. Go see Temple, Dr. Frith said as I left her office. I had, of course, heard of Temple Grandin. Everyone interested in autism has heard of her, and had read her autobiography, Emergence, labeled autistic, when it came out in 1986. When I first read the book, I could not help being suspicious of it. The autistic mind, it was supposed at that time, was incapable of self-understanding and understanding others, and therefore of authentic introspection and retrospection. How could an autistic person write an autobiography? It seemed a contradiction in terms. When I observed that the book had been written in collaboration with a journalist, I wondered whether some of its fine and unexpected qualities, its coherence, its poignancy, its often normal tone, might in fact be due to her. Such suspicions have continued to be voiced in regard to Grandin's book and to autistic autobiographies in general. But as I read Temple's papers and her many autobiographical articles, I found a detail and consistency, a directness that changed my mind. Reading her autobiography and her articles, one gets a feeling of how strange, how different she was as a child, how far removed from normal. At 6 months, she started to stiffen in her mother's arms, at 10 months to claw her like a trapped animal. Normal contact was almost impossible in these circumstances. Temple describes her world as one of sensations heightened, sometimes to an excruciating degree, and inhibited, sometimes to annihilation. She speaks of her ears at the age of 2 or 3 as helpless microphones, transmitting everything, irrespective of relevance, at full, overwhelming volume. And there was an equal lack of modulation in all her senses. She showed an intense interest in odors and a remarkable sense of smell. She was subject to sudden impulses, and when these were frustrated, violent rage. She perceived none of the usual rules and codes of human relationship. She lived, sometimes raged, inconceivably disorganized, in a world of unbridled chaos. In her 3rd year, she became destructive and violent. Normal children use clay for modeling. I used my feces and then spread my creations all over the room. I chewed up puzzles and spit the cardboard mush out on the floor. I had a violent temper, and when thwarted, I'd throw anything handy, a museum-quality vase or leftover feces. I screamed continually.
And yet, like many autistic children, she soon developed an immense power of concentration, a selectivity of attention so intense that it could create a world of its own, a place of calm and order in the chaos and tumult. I could sit on the beach for hours, dribbling sand through my fingers and fashioning miniature mountains, she writes. Each particle of sand intrigued me, as though I were a scientist looking through a microscope. Other times I scrutinized each line in my finger, following one as if it were a road on a map. Or she would spin, or spin a coin, so raptly that she saw and heard nothing else. People around me were transparent. Even a sudden loud noise didn't startle me from my world. It is not clear whether this hyperfocus of attention, an attention as narrow as it is intense, is a primary phenomenon in autism, or a reaction or adaptation to an overwhelming, uninhibited barrage of sensation. A similar hyperfocus is sometimes seen in Tourette syndrome. At 3, Temple was taken to a neurologist, and the diagnosis of autism was made. It was hinted that lifelong institutionalization would probably be necessary. The total absence of speech at this age seemed especially ominous. How, I had to wonder, had she ever moved from this almost unintelligible childhood, with its chaos, its fixations, its inaccessibility, its violence, this fierce and desperate state, which had almost led to her institutionalization at the age of 3, to the successful biologist and engineer I was going to see. I phoned Temple from the Denver airport to reconfirm our meeting. It was conceivable, I thought, that she might be somewhat inflexible about arrangements, so time and place should be set as definitely as possible. It was an hour and a quarter drive to Fort Collins, Temple said, and she provided minute directions for finding her office at Colorado State University, where she is an assistant professor in the Animal Sciences Department. At one point I missed a detail and asked Temple to repeat it, and was startled when she repeated the entire directional litany, several minutes worth, in virtually the same words. It seemed as if the directions had to be given as they were held in Temple's mind, entire, that they had fused into a fixed association or program and could no longer be separated into their components. One instruction, however, had to be modified. She had told me at first that I should turn right onto College Street at a particular intersection marked by a Taco Bell restaurant. In her second set of directions, Temple added an aside here. Said the Taco Bell had recently had a facelift and been housed in a fake cottage and no longer looked in the least bellish. I was struck by the charming, whimsical adjective, bellish. Autistic people are often called humorless, unimaginative, and bellish was surely an original concoction, a spontaneous and delightful image. I made my way to the university campus and located the Animal Sciences building, where Temple was waiting to greet me. She is a tall, strongly built woman in her mid-40s. She was wearing jeans, a knit shirt, western boots, her habitual dress. Her clothing, her appearance, her manner were plain, frank, and forthright. I had the impression of a sturdy, no-nonsense cattlewoman, with an indifference to social conventions, appearance, or ornament, an absence of frills, an absolute directness of manner and mind. When she raised her arm in greeting, the arm went too high, seemed to get caught for a moment in a sort of spasm or fixed posture, a hint, an echo, of the stereotypes she once had. Then she gave me a strong handshake and led the way down to her office. Her gait seemed to me slightly clumsy, or uncouth, as is often the case with autistic adults. Temple attributes this to a simple ataxia, associated with impaired development of the vestibular system and part of the cerebellum. Later, I did a brief neurological exam, focusing on her cerebellar function and balance. I did indeed find a little ataxia, but insufficient, I thought, to explain her odd gait. She sat me down with little ceremony, no preliminaries, no social niceties, no small talk about my trip or how I liked Colorado. Her office, crowded with papers, with work done and to do, could have been that of any academic, with photographs of her projects on the wall and animal knick-knacks she had picked up on her travels. She plunged straight into talking of her work, speaking of her early interests in psychology and animal behavior, how they were connected with self-observation and a sense of her own needs as an autistic person, and how this had joined with the visualizing and engineering part of her mind to point her toward the special field she had made her own, the design of farms, feedlots, corrals, slaughterhouses, systems of many sorts for animal management. She handed me a book containing some of the layouts she had developed over the years. The book was titled Beef Cattle Behaviors, Handling, and Facilities Design. And I admired the complex and beautiful designs inside, and the logical presentation of the book, starting with diagrams of cattle and sheep and hog behavior, and moving through designs of corrals to ever more complex ranch and feedlot facilities. She spoke well and clearly, but with a certain unstoppable impetus and fixity. A sentence, a paragraph once started, had to be completed. Nothing was left implicit, hanging in the air. I was feeling somewhat exhausted, hungry, and thirsty. I had been traveling all day and had missed lunch, and I kept hoping Temple would notice and offer me some coffee. She did not. So after an hour, almost fainting under the barrage of her over-explicit and relentless sentences and the need to attend to several things at once, not only what she was saying, which was often complex and unfamiliar, but also her mental processes, the sort of person she was, I finally asked for some coffee. There was no, "I'm sorry, I should have offered you some before." No intermediacy, no social junction. Instead, she immediately took me to a coffee pot that was kept brewing in the secretary's office upstairs. She introduced me to the secretaries in a somewhat brusque manner, giving me the feeling once again of someone who had learned, roughly, how to behave in such situations without having much personal perception of how other people felt, the nuances, the social subtleties involved. "Time to get some dinner," Temple suddenly announced after we had spent another hour in her office. "We eat early in the West." We went to a nearby Western restaurant, one with swinging doors and with guns and cattle horns on the walls. It was already crowded, as Temple had said it would be, at 5 in the afternoon, and we ordered a classic Western meal of ribs and beer. We ate heartily and talked throughout the meal about the technical aspects of Temple's work and the ways in which she sets out every design, every problem, visually in her mind. As we left the restaurant, I suggested we go for a walk, and Temple took me out to a meadow along an old railway line. The day was cooling rapidly. We were at 5,000 feet. And in the long evening light, gnats darned the air, and crickets were stridulating all around us. I found some horsetails, one of my favorite plants, in a muddy patch below the tracks, and became excited about them. Temple glanced at them, said, "Equisetum," but did not seem stirred by them as I was. On the plane to Denver, I had been reading a remarkable piece of writing by a highly gifted, normal 9-year-old, a fairy story she had created with a wonderful sense of myth, a whole world of magic, animism, and cosmogonies. What, I wondered as we walked through the horsetails, of Temple's cosmogony? How did she respond to myths or to dramas? How much did they carry meaning for her? I asked her about the Greek myths. She said that she had read many of them as a child, and that she thought of Icarus in particular. How he had flown too near the sun, and his wings had melted, and he had plummeted to his death. "I understand Nemesis and Hubris," she said.
But the loves of the gods, I ascertained, left her unmoved and puzzled. It was similar with Shakespeare's plays. She was bewildered, she said, by Romeo and Juliet. I never knew what they were up to. And with Hamlet, she got lost with the back and forth of the play. Though she ascribed these problems to sequencing difficulties, they seemed to arise from her failure to empathize with the characters, to follow the intricate play of motive and intention. She said that she could understand simple, strong, universal emotions, but was stumped by more complex emotions and the games people play. Much of the time, she said, I feel like an anthropologist on Mars. She was at pains to keep her own life simple, she said, and to make everything very clear and explicit. She had built up a vast library of experiences over the years, she went on. They were like a library of videotapes, which she could play in her mind and inspect at any time, videos of how people behaved in different circumstances. She would play these over and over again and learn by degrees to correlate what she saw so that she could then predict how people in similar circumstances might act. She had complemented her experience by constant reading, including reading of trade journals and the Wall Street Journal, all of which enlarged her knowledge of the species. It is strictly a logical process, she explained. In one plant she had designed, she said, there had been repeated breakdowns of the machinery, but these occurred only when a particular man, John, was in the room. She correlated these incidents and inferred at last that John must be sabotaging the equipment. I had to learn to be suspicious. I had to learn it cognitively. I could put two and two together, but I couldn't see the jealous look on his face. Such incidents have not been uncommon in her life. It bends some people out of shape that this autistic weirdo can come in and design all the equipment. They want the equipment, but it galls them that they can't do it themselves. But that Tom, an engineering colleague, and I can. That we've got $100,000 Sun workstations in our heads. In her ingenuousness and gullibility, Temple was, at first, a target for all sorts of tricks and exploitations. This sort of innocence or guilelessness arising not from moral virtue, but from failure to understand dissembling and pretense. The dirty devices of the world, in Traherne's phrase, is almost universal among the autistic. But over the years, Temple has learned, in her indirect way, by inspecting her library, some of the ways of the world. She has, in fact, been able to found her own company and to work as a freelance consultant to and designer of animal facilities all over the world. By professional standards, she is extraordinarily successful. But other human interactions, social, sexual, she cannot get. My work is my life, she told me several times. There is not that much else. There seemed to me pain, renunciation, resolution, and acceptance all mixed together in her voice. And these are the feelings that sound through her writings. In one article she writes, I do not fit in with the social life of my town or university. Almost all of my social contacts are with livestock people or people interested in autism. Most of my Friday and Saturday nights are spent writing papers and drawing. My interests are factual, and my recreational reading consists mostly of science and livestock publications. I have little interest in novels with complicated interpersonal relationships, because I am unable to remember the sequence of events. Detailed descriptions of new technologies in science fiction or descriptions of exotic places are much more interesting. My life would be horrible if I did not have my challenging career. Early the next morning, a Saturday, Temple picked me up in her four-wheel drive
a rugged vehicle she drives all over the West to visit farms, ranches, corrals, and meat plants. As we headed for her house, I quizzed her about the work she had done for her PhD. Her thesis was on the effects of enriched and impoverished environments on the development of pigs' brains. She told me about the great differences that developed between the two groups, how sociable and delightful the enriched pigs became, how hyper-excitable and aggressive and almost autistic the impoverished ones were, by contrast. She wondered whether impoverishment of experience was not a contributing factor in human autism. "I got to love my enriched pigs," she said. "I was very attached. I was so attached I couldn't kill them." The animals had to be sacrificed at the end of the experiment so their brains could be examined. She described how the pigs at the end, trusting her, let her lead them on their last walk, and how she had calmed them by stroking them and talking to them while they were killed. She was very distressed at their deaths. I wept and wept. She had just finished the story when we arrived at her home, a small two-story townhouse some distance from the campus. Downstairs was comfortable with the usual amenities, a sofa, armchairs, a television, pictures on the wall, but I had the sense that it was rarely used. There was an immense sepia print of her grandfather's farm in Grandin, North Dakota, in 1880. Her other grandfather, she told me, had invented the automatic pilot for planes. These two were the progenitors, she feels, of her agricultural and engineering talents. Upstairs was her study with her typewriter, but no word processor, absolutely bursting with manuscripts and books, books everywhere, spilling out of the study into every room in the house. My own little house was once described as a machine for working, and I had a somewhat similar impression of temples. On one wall was a large cowhide with a huge collection of identity badges and caps from the hundreds of conferences she has lectured at. I was amused to see, side by side, an ID from the American Meat Institute and one from the American Psychiatric Association. Temple has published more than 100 papers, divided between those on animal behavior and facilities management and those on autism. The intimate blending of the two was epitomized by the medley of badges side by side. Finally, without diffidence or embarrassment, emotions unknown to her, Temple showed me her bedroom, an austere room with whitewashed walls and a single bed, and next to the bed, a very large, strange-looking object. "What is that?" I asked. "That's my squeeze machine," Temple replied. "Some people call it my hug machine." The device had two heavy, slanting wooden sides, perhaps 4 by 3 feet each, pleasantly upholstered with thick, soft padding. They were joined by hinges to a long, narrow bottom board to create a V-shaped, body-sized trough. There was a complex control box at one end, with heavy-duty tubes leading off to another device in a closet. Temple showed me this as well. "It's an industrial compressor," she said, "the kind they use for filling tires." "And what does this do?" "It exerts a firm but comfortable pressure on the body, from the shoulders to the knees," Temple said. "Either a steady pressure, or a variable one, or a pulsating one as you wish," she added. "You crawl into it, I'll show you, and turn the compressor on, and you have all the controls in your hand here right in front of you." When I asked her why one should seek to submit oneself to such pressure, she told me, when she was a little girl, she said, she had longed to be hugged, but had at the same time been terrified of all contact. When she was hugged, especially by a favorite but vast aunt, she felt overwhelmed, overcome by sensation. She had a sense of peacefulness and pleasure, but also of terror and engulfment.
She started to have daydreams, she was just 5 at the time, of a magic machine that could squeeze her powerfully but gently, in a hug-like way, and in a way entirely commanded and controlled by her. Years later, as an adolescent, she had seen a picture of a squeeze chute designed to hold or restrain calves, and realized that that was it. A little modification to make it suitable for human use, and it could be her magic machine. She had considered other devices, inflatable suits, which could exert an even pressure all over the body, but the squeeze chute, in its simplicity, was quite irresistible. Being of a practical turn of mind, she soon made her fantasy come true. The early models were crude, with some snags and glitches, but she eventually evolved a totally comfortable, predictable system, capable of administering a hug with whatever parameters she desired. Her squeeze machine had worked exactly as she hoped, yielding the very sense of calmness and pleasure she had dreamed of since childhood. She could not have gone through the stormy days of college without her squeeze machine, she said. She could not turn to human beings for solace and comfort, but she could always turn to it. The machine, which she neither exhibited nor concealed but kept openly in her room at college, excited derision and suspicion, and was seen by psychiatrists as a regression or fixation, something that needed to be psychoanalyzed and resolved. With her characteristic stubbornness, tenacity, single-mindedness, and bravery, along with a complete absence of inhibition or hesitation, Temple ignored all these comments and reactions and determined to find a scientific validation of her feelings. Both before and after writing her doctoral thesis, she made a systematic investigation of the effects of deep pressure in autistic people, college students, and animals, and recently, a paper of hers on this was published in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. Today, her squeeze machine, variously modified, is receiving extensive clinical trials. She has also become the world's foremost designer of squeeze chutes for cattle, and has published, in the meat industry and veterinary literature, many articles on the theory and practice of humane restraint and gentle holding. While telling me this, Temple knelt down, then eased herself face down and at full length into the V, turned on the compressor. It took a minute for the master cylinder to fill, and twisted the controls. The sides converged, clasping her firmly, and then, as she made a small adjustment, relaxed their grip slightly. It was the most bizarre thing I had ever seen, and yet, for all its oddness, it was moving and simple. Certainly there was no doubt of its effect. Temple's voice, often loud and hard, became softer and gentler as she lay in her machine. "I concentrate on how gently I can do it," she said, and then spoke of the necessity of totally giving into it. "I'm getting real relaxed now," she added quietly. "I guess others get this through relation with other people." It is not just pleasure or relaxation that Temple gets from the machine, but, she maintains, a feeling for others. As she lies in her machine, she says her thoughts often turn to her mother, her favorite aunt, her teachers. She feels their love for her and hers for them. She feels that the machine opens a door into an otherwise closed emotional world and allows her, almost teaches her, to feel empathy for others. After 20 minutes or so, she emerged, visibly calmer, emotionally less rigid. She says that a cat can easily sense the difference in her at these times, and asked me if I would care to try the machine. Indeed, I was curious and scrambled into it, feeling a little foolish and self-conscious, but less so than I might have been because Temple herself was so wholly lacking in self-consciousness.
She turned the compressor on again and filled the master cylinder, and I experimented gingerly with the controls. It was indeed a sweet, calming feeling, one that reminded me of my deep-diving days long ago, when I felt the pressure of the water on my diving suit as a whole-body embrace. After my own trial in the squeeze machine, and with both of us suitably relaxed, we drove out to the university's experimental farm, where Temple does much of her basic fieldwork. I had earlier thought there might be a separation, even a gulf between the personal and, so to speak, private realm of her autism and the public realm of her professional expertise. But it was becoming increasingly clear to me that they were hardly separated at all. For her, the personal and the professional, the inward and the outward, were completely fused. Cattle are disturbed by the same sorts of sounds as autistic people. High-pitched sounds, air hissing, or sudden loud noises. They cannot adapt to these, Temple told me. But they are not bothered by low-pitched, rumbling noises. They are disturbed by high visual contrasts, shadows, or sudden movements. A light touch will make them pull away. A firm touch calms them. The way I would pull away from being touched is the way a wild cow will pull away. Getting me used to being touched is very similar to taming a wild cow. It was precisely her sense of the common ground, in terms of basic sensations and feelings between animals and people, that allowed her to show such sensitivity to animals, and to insist so forcefully on their humane management. She had been primed to this knowledge, she felt, partly through the experience of her own autism, and partly because she came from a long line of farmers, and, as a child, had spent much of her time on farms. And her own mode of thinking allowed her no escape from these realities. If you're a visual thinker, it's easier to identify with animals, she said as we drove to the farm. If all your thought processes are in language, how could you imagine that cattle think? But if you think in pictures... Temple has always been a powerful visualizer. She was astonished when she discovered that her own near-hallucinatory power of visual imagery was not universal. That there were others who apparently had other ways to think. She is still very puzzled by this. How do you think? She kept asking me. But she had no sense that she could draw, make blueprints, until she was 28. When she met a draftsman and watched him drawing plans. I saw how he did it, she told me. I went and got exactly the same instruments and pencils as he used. A 0.5mm HB pentel, and then I started pretending I was him. The drawing did itself, and when it was all done, I couldn't believe I'd done it. I didn't have to learn how to draw or design. I pretended I was David. I appropriated him, drawing and all. Temple constantly runs simulations, as she calls them, in her head. I visualize the animal entering the chute from different angles, different distances, zooming in or wide angle, even from a helicopter view. Or I turn myself into an animal, and feel what it would feel entering the chute. But if one thinks only in pictures, I could not help reflecting. One might not understand what non-visual thinking was like, and one would miss the richness and ambiguity, the cultural presuppositions, the depth of language. All autistics, Temple had said earlier, were intensely visual thinkers like her. If this was true, was it, I wondered, more than a coincidence? Was Temple's intense visuality a vital clue to her autism?
A cattle farm, even a large one, is often a quiet place. But when we arrived, we could hear a great tumult of bellowing. "They must have separated the calves from the cows this morning," Temple said. And indeed, this was what had happened. We saw one cow outside the stockade, roaming, looking for her calf, and bellowing. "That's not a happy cow," Temple said. "That's one sad, unhappy, upset cow. She wants her baby. Bellowing for it, hunting for it. She'll forget for a while, then start again. It's like grieving, mourning, not much written about it. People don't like to allow them thoughts or feelings. Skinner wouldn't allow them." As an undergraduate in New Hampshire, she had written to B.F. Skinner, the great behaviorist, and finally, she had visited him. "It was like having an audience with God," she said. "It was a letdown. He was just a regular human being. He said, 'We don't have to know how the brain works. It's just a matter of conditioned reflexes.' No way I could believe it was just stimulus response." The Skinner era, Temple concluded, was one that denied feelings to animals and rationalized regarding them as automata. It was an era of exceptional cruelty, both in animal experimentation and in the management of farms and slaughterhouses. She had read somewhere that behaviorism was an uncaring science, and this was exactly how she herself felt about it. Her own aspiration was to bring a vivid sense of animals' feelings back into husbandry. Seeing the grieving cow and hearing the bereft bellows angered Temple and turned her mind toward inhumanities and slaughter. She had nothing to do with chickens, she said, but the killing of chickens was particularly loathsome. "When it's time for chickens to go to McNugget Land, they pick them up, hang them upside down, cut their throats." A similar shackling of cattle and hanging them upside down so that the blood rushes to their heads before their throats are cut is a common sight in old kosher slaughterhouses, she said. "Sometimes their legs get broken. They scream in pain and terror." Mercifully, such practices are now starting to change. "Properly performed, slaughter is more humane than nature," she went on. 8 seconds after the throat's cut, endorphins are released. The animal dies without pain. It is similar in nature after sheep have been ripped up by coyotes. Nature has done this to ease the pain of a dying animal. What is terrible, the more so because it is avoidable, she feels, is pain and cruelty. The introduction of fear and stress before the lethal cutting. And it is this that she is most concerned to prevent. "I want to reform the meat industry. The activists want to shut it down," she said, and added, "I don't like radical anything, left or right. I have a radical dislike of radicals." Away from the bellowing of the separated calves and mothers, whose distress Temple seemed to feel in her bones, we found a calm, quiet area of the farm where cattle were browsing placidly. Temple knelt and held out some hay, and a cow came over to her and took the hay, nudging her hand with its soft muzzle. A soft, happy look came over Temple's face. "Now I'm at home," she said. "When I'm with cattle, it's not at all cognitive. I know what the cow's feeling." The cattle seemed to sense this, sensed her calm, her confidence, and came up to her hand. They did not come up to me, sensing perhaps the unease of the city dweller, who, living mostly in a world of cultural conventions and signals, is unsure how to behave with huge nonverbal animals. "It's different with people," she went on, repeating her earlier remark about feeling like an anthropologist on Mars. "Studying the people there, trying to figure out the natives, but I don't feel like that with animals.
I was struck by the enormous difference, the gulf between Temple's immediate intuitive recognition of animal moods and signs and her extraordinary difficulties understanding human beings, their codes and signals, the way they conduct themselves. One cannot say that she is devoid of feeling or has a fundamental lack of sympathy. On the contrary, her sense of animals' moods and feelings is so strong that these almost take possession of her, overwhelm her at times. She feels she can have sympathy for what is physical or physiological, for an animal's pain or terror, but lacks empathy for people's states of mind and perspectives. When she was younger, she was hardly able to interpret even the simplest expressions of emotion. She learned to decode them later, without necessarily feeling them. Similarly, Dr. Hermelin in London had told me a story about an intelligent autistic girl of 12 who came to her and said of another student, "Joni is making a funny noise." Upon going to investigate, Hermelin found Joni crying bitterly. The meaning of weeping had been completely missed by the autistic girl. She had merely registered it as something physical, a funny noise. I was reminded, too, of Jessie Park and how she was fascinated by the fact that onions could make one weep, but was totally unable to comprehend that one could also weep for joy. "I can tell if a human being is angry," she told me, "or if he's smiling." At the level of the sensory motor, the concrete, the unmediated, the animal, Temple has no difficulty. But what about children, I asked her. Were they not intermediate between animals and adults? On the contrary, Temple said, she had great difficulties with children, trying to talk with them, to join in their games. She could not even play peekaboo with a baby, she said, because she would get the timing all wrong, as she had had such difficulties herself as a child. Children, she feels, are already far advanced by the age of 3 or 4, along a path that she, as an autistic person, has never advanced far on. Little children, she feels, already understand other human beings in a way she can never hope to. What is it then, I pressed her further, that goes on between normal people, from which she feels herself excluded? It has to do, she has inferred, with an implicit knowledge of social conventions and codes, of cultural presuppositions of every sort. This implicit knowledge, which every normal person accumulates and generates throughout life on the basis of experience and encounters with others, Temple seems to be largely devoid of. Lacking it, she has instead to compute others' intentions and states of mind, to try to make algorithmic, explicit, what for the rest of us is second nature. She herself, she infers, may never have had the normal social experiences from which a normal social knowledge is constructed. And it may be from this, too, that her difficulties with gesture and language stem. Difficulties that were devastating when she was a near-speechless child, and also in the early days of speech, when she mixed all her pronouns up, not able to grasp the different meanings of you and